How's it going, Relay community? I'm here with Stephanie Flippin for another Coach's Corner edition. And we have a guest today to talk all things form, form cues, form, myths. Paul McKinnon is here, known online as The Balanced Runner. That's his brand that he's been, well, I'll let him explain how long that's been going on. But really, we're just excited to have a whole conversation about what feels like a taboo topic in the running world. Like, how do you even, the moment you go from moving to talking about moving or writing about the movement, things get a little weird. And so I just always say, I grew up in an era where people just didn't talk about it. It was like, you don't talk about people's or changing people's form because that'll just lead bad. Yeah. What, Stephanie, how, I mean, you're a little younger than me. What's it been like in your era of coming up and running?
I feel like it's been fairly similar. I feel like I've heard that sort of phrase, like, don't fix what isn't broken. And something that I definitely wanted to chat with Paul about is because I do come from being a physician as my initial primary career path. But I've always been about like preventative medicine, something about like the U.S. healthcare system. Paul, I'm sure you're like well aware that's always frustrating is it's retroactive. It's so annoying because it's like we're just throwing Band-Aids on things. And so something that I really love just about all of the content that you share, just the stories that you have on your website as well, is the fact that like you can get ahead of injuries and prevention by working with you and your types of philosophies. But I do feel like it goes against maybe a little bit of what I grew up hearing about, like, you know, like, well, don't fixate too much on this, like, don't try to change it. But I know for myself over the years, I've noticed a few imbalances. I've been fortunate to be fairly like resilient, but I've always been curious, like, what could I be doing just preventatively, just small minor adjustments. So I'm excited to dive into all of that with you.
Yeah. So Paul, when someone is like, oh, you know, you introduce yourself, like, what do you do? How do you even begin to describe it?
Yeah. Well, I guess because of everything you've just said, it is a really like a niche side of things. And it's like, oh, okay. Like, well, I didn't know there was something about that. And look, to be honest, like I grew up, well, probably a little bit older than you, Pete, but like grew up in a similar time where it was this, oh, you don't change it, or if you do, these are the kind of things you got to focus on, but don't change it. So there was almost this contradictory kind of conversation in that. So if you were to change it, this is it, but don't, you know? So don't, I kind of grew up with that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I grew up with that as well, but it just didn't make sense to me that, you know, like running is this only movement pattern that you're not supposed to change to improve, like in anything else, everything else. Like you can become more efficient in a movement, in a position, both. So it just didn't make sense to me in that regard. And I think what it then came back to is that I just probably wasn't done very well. So it's really easy to kind of have that conversation around, don't do it, because if it isn't done well, then yeah, don't do it. If you don't do it properly, don't change. Mm. And then we've probably progressed a little bit further on now. There are sort of more practitioners going, okay, well, if it's broken, then we can have a go at it. You know, like if you're broken down or continually breaking down, then we can kind of have a go. But I think that's just a safety net that people use so that they can like start to throw a few things at someone to try and change it, rather than understanding that everyone is on like the same spectrum. It's just about where are you starting it from. So Stephanie asked before about, if someone turns up to ask about like an improvement, you know, like we can actually get them further away from that injury, you know, pattern, but it's still now all on that same spectrum of getting towards a performance base. So even if they're starting from an injury start point, we're still moving them towards better performance based on like an efficiency of movement and how to best move and where those movements are coming from. So that I find it sort of how I sort of see things.
I find it fascinating. Once we've started to engage, Paul and I met a year or two ago, and thinking about there's, you know, and you maybe can break this down for us, Paul, like there is movement in a moment, there's efficiency over a period of time, and then there's just your ability to avoid impact injury, to stay training, you know, the things that keep you moving so that you can have more of the baseline training. And all of those are impacted by how you're you're moving. And if you zoom out, particularly as a athlete who's been in the sport and go, what, I don't move in any very, it's very unlikely I move similarly how I moved in high school, how I moved in college. Then I started working an office desk, at desk job. Like as humans, we're always kind of like ebbing and flowing and how our body's moving. And so even, I think it's just, it's scary to consider. It's like safer to just be like, that's a thing I don't have to worry about. But like a lot of things like strength training or nutrition, other topics we've talked about in more depth on this Coach's Corner, movement patterns, I think are, like we described, difficult to talk about, but important to like at least consider. So how would you even break it down for us? Like the listener who's like, what are you even talking about?
Well, I think the easiest thing is like the way you move directly results in how you relate to the ground. Everything is about our relationship with the ground. And we always continually try and change that relationship. But everything you do from, you know, from top down to bottom is going to influence how heavy or how light or how hard or how long or, you know, like where. So if we just think about the way you move directly influences that. You can either move in a manner that influences it really poorly, or you can move in a manner that influences it really well, like or our best case. So I think once you start to think about, like, you can have a varying degree, you can still run from A to B. Yeah. Your relationship is still in this variance between really, really good or really, really helpful or best case through to somewhat less helpful, somewhat less safe.
What I thought, so for those listening, I had Paul last time, Paul, you're in Australia, and last time he was in Oregon, I had him meet with three of my athletes that I coach in person. And what I thought your techniques were fascinating because what you started off the conversation by saying, you know, any history of any injury history, any things that crop up, you know, how have things been going for you? What are you looking for? And then having someone just run down and run back with no direction or no anything. And I mean, these are three athletes who are coming from running from very different parts of life, have very different movement patterns. And I am not a PT. You know, I'm trying to be like someone who can guide people on their running journey, but just seeing how someone's movement pattern was substantiating the things that they had talked about. You know, one man, you know, he said, yeah, I have a lot of Achilles and calf, you know, that type of pain, that type of injury. And then sure enough, he heads down the runway and it's all back flick, you know, all below the knee, all braking force, landing force, braking force, and acceleration force coming right through that spot. And you just think, whoa, yeah, obviously. Yeah. So even if he talked 6 months ago and he was injury free and on a PR train, that's still going to be the point of interface with the ground. And it's where all success and failure is, a lot of it's going to come from, versus someone else who, you know, who has a very different movement pattern, even if it's just running, just wild how different that is. So,
well, I guess the two parts to your question and the first part, like that's exactly what I was just talking about a second ago. It's like the way you move directly relates to or influences the relationship with the ground. Now that can be through landing and impact or through propulsive. So it's like, what movements are you making as you come into the ground? And what movements are you making to create force to come off the ground? And in that case, or that example you used, everything I do in the first conversation, often like there's two parts to it. Often someone just likes to be heard about like what they're doing and what they've experienced in their running. But it gives me such feedback into how they speak, the language that they use, the experiences that they've had, so that I can utilize that stuff within the session as well. We can directly relate back to it or use the same language. And it's kind of like the teaching or the coaching side of things. But before, I like to have that conversation before I even see them run, because what we can start to do is, okay, cool. I've got this idea in my head of where they're loading. Now I want to see them run so I can see if that directly relates or matches up. And once we can do that, and as you saw, it's like, well, I can get the person to feel everything that they're doing, any imbalances, something like you talked about, Steph, is get them to feel it, to then even just explain in their own head is like, why am I getting this stuff over and over? Or why did I just get this? as you said, like, it's not like they just started making this movement and now they got those injuries. It's a buildup of that load, that repetition of movement at intensity or frequency, which, you know, which is running. And then it's like what you're doing is directly loading these because of the pattern, the movement that you are making. Now that you feel it, now we can start to change it. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like that first step before we can start to change it, because it's almost like teaching an athlete to feel or understand what they're not doing well. Like, I don't like to say wrong, just what they're not doing well and what it feels like, so that when we do make a change, they recognize when they go back to the old patterns. But also that contrast, like the new way, old way method, like it's a skill development method so that they can actually tell that it's an improvement. You know, particularly when we talk about the beauty of running is that everything we do, it creates that feel and that understanding and that relationship with the ground. If it is a positive change, they will feel a positive change. Mm-hmm. And that becomes like huge for a running athlete, because like, holy shit, like this is freer, lighter, faster, whatever it is that we're working on at the time. Like, there is a direct internal awareness of improvement, not one of us like saying, oh, that looked better.
Yeah.
No, like there's a feel of, geez, this actually feels better. And so we don't have to do anything from there anymore.
I think one of your first like pinned posts on your Instagram page, and I know you've written a piece about it, was on hip drop. And over the years, like I mentioned, I've been a fairly resilient athlete, but I've worked with multiple strength coaches and they're like, we really need to fix this hip drop on you. I don't think I've ever had it like actually measured, like the percentage in terms of like quantifying it. But you know, I just feel like I've always been given like, let's just really, you know, strengthen the glute medius, right? And like just hammer away at all this strength work. And my issue has really never been like weak glutes. My issue has always been implementing like, and that awareness of where my hips are in space. And like you said, at faster paces and like at my race pace. And that's like where I've always struggled to find, like to put all of the pieces together. And I really just haven't been able to find someone who has been able to really connect the dots with that type of physical awareness. So your post like that you mentioned about like the impact of arm swing, that was sort of like a light bulb for me. I texted Peter about it. I was like, oh my gosh, I really would love to consider that as well. I'd love to hear more about your thoughts in terms of like creating that awareness so that the athlete understands like where their body is in space. Cause that's been something that I have personally struggled with.
Yeah. So there's probably a couple of bits to it that if you're concentrating, particularly hips, it's because it's so integral. It's so like, it's like the middle piece, like it connects everything. But if we're just trying to like lock it down and hold it tight by, you know, like strength or just like, okay, don't let it drop, or don't let it, try and hold it still. What we're probably missing in that is like, what is happening through the torso? What's happening in the shoulders? What's happening through that arm swing, like you mentioned, that actually influences that hip position or even the hip tilt. So a lot of the tilt comes into it as well. So whether it's a drop or a tilt or a rotation, all of that is going to be influenced by everything above it. And that post that you talked about, and I even mentioned that all we worked on was like shoulder position and arm swing. If we can keep the shoulders still and in the right position by, you know, swinging in the right manner, but also holding your shoulders in the right position, straight away the hips can stay still. They don't have to counter. So what happens is you kind of start, and we'll go to this, I'm sure, at some point, like the process of where I've flipped it and gone top down is because you can't start to fix or implement changes down the chain until you're doing the thing above. It's like trying to do a deadlift or a squat with your feet next to each other or your legs crossed. Oh. You know, like you're going, oh, I've got everything sorted up here and, you know, like I'm holding it right and I'm trying to do the right cues of going through the correct movement patterns and in the correct position. Why can't I get there? Because if we flip it, the thing that should be most still, it's not stationary, but still in a squat is feet. And then you've got to fit them within, you know, your body position and your hip mobility and all that sort of stuff actually comes into the individual. Then you can work up the chain. Whereas running, it's completely flipped. Like feet are the outcome of everything that happens. They're the thing that moves the most. So that's why it becomes that.
What's so crazy is it feels like the start of this conversation in my world was like born to run, barefoot running, toe, you know, this whole thing around, like, you need to land on your toes, not on your heels. And, you know, there's millions of people. So there's millions of runners and there's millions of movement patterns. But that thing you just said, like the foot strike being the expression of everything the things you're doing with your body, not the foot strike being the outcome. I think a lot of the
foot strike being the focus. It's the expression of, or it's the outcome of. Yeah.
I know Stephanie's been in a lab. I've been in labs where they say, like, okay, we'd like you to run as naturally as possible and hit this force plate. And that's a great example when you can do it. It sometimes takes some time, but the number one thing you end up doing when you're novice to it is running down in the last second, like shoving out your foot and hitting the force plate in a totally unnatural manner. And I think of that as like sort of an analogous thing to if someone said, like, hit the ground like this. And I mean, I just did some YouTube searching for, you know, form cues, best form running. And there's a million words. That's the problem. There's so many synonyms for, like, I came across the tripod foot or the forefoot or the, and if you're moving down the road, trying to forcibly hit the ground in a certain way, like Stephanie described, it's just very different than being in the flow in the moment of, you know, accelerated running, racing, you know, the things we talk more about, being lost in that movement pattern. So maybe, without listing every style of, like, fad of, you know, running form guruism, like, can you talk to us about what is this element of top down versus bottom up?
Well, this is like the, without mentioning names of groups or whatever that is, it's like we're trying to fit it within a framework. Whereas for me, the framework I'm trying to fit it within is, like, physics and the physical nature of the individual. So they're going to have certain lengths of limbs and joint ranges and joint. And there's like a musculoskeletal nature that is like fits within that. But then all the movements have to fit within physics as well. So it's not like, okay, you need to do A, B, and C, you need to do this movement. It's like that mechanic is a real mechanic, like a running mechanic, which is different from a walking mechanic. And we're trying to get from A to B, but we're governed by physics. So, like, we're getting kind of a little bit nerdy in the side of the things, but it's literally our biggest inhibitor is gravity. So what movements are we making and in what position are we making them to best fight gravity? We don't want to fight the ground. We want to use the ground. So that's kind of like the big, broader side of things. And then you start to go, okay, what does each body part do within this mechanic? What is their function? What is their role? And there's no job sharing there. Whereas I think there's a few things and there's a few different groups that are kind of like, oh, what does this and this? And you got to land this way. Don't worry about anything else. So something as simple as, like, we spoke about it and use you as an example, Pete, so we don't kind of sort of get a little bit out of shape here. But we think about, like, a body position when we're told to have, and in some cases, some of these examples are talking about, you know, chest out, chest forward, you know, run tall. But it actually limits breath capacity. It takes your center of mass backwards. It limits range of motion of femur swing. So everything we're trying to get when we're running is going to be influenced by that one cue. So you get limited lung capacity, and oxygen is pretty key for running. Like, we want hip extension, but we want to do it in a manner that it's actually a relationship between flexion and extension. And if you're going to limit that because of your position, so we're going, okay, if that doesn't work, it's not the right cue, or it's not the right method.
Yeah.
So we think about it shouldn't be just a method. There should be just, like, a way. It's not, okay, well, I'm going to try and fit people within this method. Even in other movement patterns, like swimming or something like that, yeah, there's methods, but there's just A to B to C, and that works best. That's best case scenario. Should it be a method?
Yeah. The other way of, I think, approaching it we've talked about is, you know, movement is stride rate versus stride length. You know, like, those are the two things that come into fruition. And correct me if I misspeak, but I know a lot of people run into, okay, my cadence is 180, 190 a minute, almost 200. Where do I go from there? We're thinking about stride length. And I mean, it sort of, I guess, stands to reason to begin to explore that.
Let's go into that, because I think this is going to be like a real big key to like where a lot of things went wrong. When it was stride length was the first thought process. It's like, oh, cool, how do we get a longer stride? And that was immediately the reach out. And then it became an overstride. Then it became, you know, breaking force. So it was, if we want to get a longer stride, it has to be longer out in front. It's got to be, that's where we get our length from. Someone got it very, very wrong at that point. When stride length comes from flight, it comes from being in the air for a longer period of time. The longer you are in the air, you know, the less energy, but it also gives you more time for your center of mass to catch up, to then be on top of your landing. So rather than we're going back to like feet and lower first, it's like land under your hips. You've got to be landing under your hips so there's no breaking force. Like, we've got to give ourselves time to actually catch up to our foot so we're over top of it. Then we land underneath our hips. It's like completely flipped. So it was the wrong way around. But then in that case of the stride length, the reach out, get length from like a longer, if I can, and now we can go into like
chucking your foot out there.
Now let's just pad up the heel of our shoe so I can go even further out there and pop this force. Like, no. We want to work in a manner that actually utilizes tendons, muscles, springs, so we can get off the ground and we can actually fly and float and make maximize each stride, not lengthen our movement. Yeah, so then it's like it's a longer movement.
Yeah.
Not a longer stride. So then that started to stuff us up. So from that point, then it was like, oh, shit, now we're getting all these injuries from breaking force and impact and all this sort of stuff. Like, okay, shorten it. How do we shorten it? Increase your cadence. Okay, now we've got to run at this cadence. So, like, it's just this kind of, like, this confusion of what has actually made up best case. So then we're trying to fit, like, people within.
Putting your back into best case.
Yeah, it's like square peg, round hole. And it's like, just jam it in here. Why can't you run at this cadence? Because it's like, the stupidity, I'm passionate about this, but the stupidity of it
180
is the same thing as saying you got to run it.
Well,
180, which blows my mind to think that that's a thing, because then it's the same thing as saying no. Well, it's akin to saying you got to run at X stride length, and all you have is cadence, a variable.
Yeah. No, like, just
that's the stupidity of sort of, we're just trying to go, okay, now let's just make it, I'm going to do that. There's a hard and fast rule. Let's stick to that. Now we've got to just going to kind of work within that. No, because then 180, it's like saying that a sprinter has to run at 180, just the same as like an ultra runner has to run away. It's all, again, we're talking about like that spectrum or that range. Everyone's in that range. So we probably want to use stride length and range first before then we want to use cadence. So we kind of use that as like, naturally, cadence will increase as stride length increases because the power output and all that sort of stuff is the turnover. But then once you get to your stride length, like, I'm shorter than other people or shorter legs, or some people got longer legs. So once you get to your stride length, all you've got is then cadence to increase. But if you just stick to one, you don't. So I think there's probably been a little bit of misunderstanding and lost in, because we've been so lower leg or foot and leg focused, that it's caused that sort of misunderstanding.
You know, when you were describing like ultra runners, like you might not always be running at 180. It reminded me, I feel like it was either like via Strava, or maybe it was an article that came out that was like analyzing Jim Walmsley's cadence. And like in some of his best performances, it came out that his like average cadence, like even him running like 5:30 minute per mile pace, like just sending it on the trail, was like 164, like, or something like that. And to me, that made sense. Like, I'm barely 5'2". I'm like 5'1.5". Like, oftentimes my cadence is like 190, like at marathon effort. I mean, that's, you know, I'm short. My legs are not long. But I just think about Jim Walmsley's stride and like the amount of time that he's in the air. And he does have more of an atypical, quote, form. And I just remembered the article.
Is that atypical form? Because I haven't seen Jim run a lot. Is that atypical form for trail or just atypical form?
It's just beautiful.
It's gorgeous.
It's just like gorgeous. Yeah. He's just flight. Yeah. It is just.
Yeah. So this is the thing. So on the trails.
No. But
because I haven't seen. No, this is perfect. Yeah. Because in trails, like, there's all these things like, I've got to conserve energy. You take small little steps. You're going for 100 miles. Why would you want to take double the amount of steps? Why wouldn't you want to spend that time in the air? Because that also allows you that balance of timing and control and strength. which is so critical for trail.
Yeah. You know, and I just remember, I felt like I saw tons of comments on social media that was like, what, that's wild that his cadence is, quote, so low. And I'm like, I don't know why we're fixating on this arbitrary number, like, that clearly is not impacting his ability to perform at the very highest level of the sport. I always think of that example when I have athletes reach out to me, like wanting to like, how do I increase my cadence? How do I do this? And I'm like, well, like, I don't know if that's really what we should choose to be focused on here. And like you mentioned, Paul, like, especially something like that, just in isolation as one variable.
I definitely think, I mean, the more we talk about this, and we're already pretty geeked out, my mind just bends, realizing how many different runners impact the ground differently. You know, I've known great, great, let's say milers who just like have so much force and they can do so well, but they're always dinged up. And it's like, they're, you know, it's like, oh, their career was short. They weren't able to really stay competitive for very long because yeah, the impact force is grand. And however they're transferring it, they're blowing out their Achilles. Their foot is always sore. And I'm like, that's just we're literally almost doing different sports, even though like I've run a mile and he's a great miler. I know that what we're describing is all these like spectrums that different people are on. I remember the first time I ran with a woman who's a 230 marathoner, and she's a little taller than you, Steph, but I was like almost distracted by how, you know, cause she was turning over at 200 and 190 to 200. And you're just like, whoa. So very little flight, tremendous turnover. I don't know how you think about impact force or, you know, ground contact. I feel like that's another thing that's hard to quantify without a lot of science, but impacts is really what we're talking about when people are saying like, oh, I keep running into this issue. And I know a lot of, Paul, we got connected around, you know, some pro athletes who we both know who had run into things in their career. And so it wasn't so much like Steph, you were saying, if it's not broken, don't fix it. It was kind of broken, and or they were experiencing discomfort, pain in different ways, and they were open-minded to you know, pulling up in that box and saying like, what is my movement pattern and how could it be improved?
Well, I think you can go to that not broken, not fix it, and you know, like, you know, the studies about injuries for runners and how many have it. So the reality is at one point or another it has been broken.
Yeah.
So unless you have never had a single injury and you've been running, it has been broken. So there's a chance to fix it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, we think about everyone in the same spectrum. It's like, oh, so you've never been injured before. No, I'm just not injured now. Okay, so what are you doing to manage it? So I'm not doing the intensity. Okay, so it has been broken. So even if you want to look at it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
Love that.
There's not a single, unless they've just started, there's normally someone who's had a history of running, there's not a single one of them who's never had a single injury.
Yeah, for sure.
Sadly,
yeah. But I think for me, that's because of the person, like the guy that you're talking about, or the athlete you're talking about, Pete. You look about like the best movers compared to we're not talking about fast runners because we've got to differentiate the two. Mm-hmm. The best movers, their injury profiles are so level. You know, it might be a spike of intensity or a spike of load that's kind of like, oh, shoot, like I'm a little bit sore here. And they can kind of manage it. The ones that don't move well, who just may happen to be fast, they got these injury profiles like this.
Yeah, that's so true.
Like the two extremes I use is like Kipchoge and Katata. You know, Katata, phenomenal athlete.
Amazing.
You may as well, it's like the peaks of the Alps. Like he's out with that. Like he can't get consistent. He might have a huge engine and be able to run fast, but the movement patterns he goes through is such a force that A, he needs that engine to run fast, but B, it's costing him so much in an impact sense. So you're kind of looking at it that as well.
And you look at, I mean, a lot of Kipchoge's principles that he speaks about now that he's become more like a bigger voice in the sport make some sense to me when you consider he really is able to stack, you know, like small bricks on top of each other. His classically, they talk about his workouts. It'll be, you know, 6, 8 by 2K on the track, and he'll just lead one and then relinquish the lead to his group. And no, he sets the pace. And it's not particularly difficult. It's like those B+ workouts, but he's not going through these down cycles of injury, so he's able to keep building. As opposed to the people who miss so much time and go like, I don't know why I'm not improving. You know, I'm doing hard workouts. I'm doing all the things. I'm curious how you when athletes come to you and they say, I mean, it's hard. Injury is such a part of the sport that I think what we're acknowledging is it just goes almost unacknowledged, or it's like not talked about.
Problem. I think, yeah, there's an acceptance that it's part and parcel of the sport. It doesn't have to be as big a piece to the puzzle. Mm-hmm. Like I think people and a lot of people who have coaches who are like really conservative and they do the best that they can in kind of managing athletes' loads. Like there's some that aren't very good, unfortunately, but that I think for the most part, and I would say like the majority have got best, they mean well, and they've got best means in mind for their athletes for sure. But even the most conservative approach won't help an athlete who's loading a tissue that doesn't condition in the manner that we want it to. So we're thinking about if you're loading, you know, bones and joints in your impact rather than muscles and tendons, it doesn't matter how conservative you are in your approach. It just becomes, where's the breaking point? So you can't actually have like a 5% or a 10% increase in the load. So it's like, yeah, what tissue are you loading through your movement patterns? Then you can understand like, oh, well, then you might be doing the best case you can, but this person's moving in a manner. Or even in something as simple as like, particularly with beginners, or even for something like if we're doing like ultra trail stuff who aren't like elites, it's okay, we need to get used to running easy. You know, like let's forget about like the you need to do lots of easy running. And you do. But a movement pattern that someone has to go through to feel like they are running, so creating flight, so getting both feet off the ground at one point in time, might be faster than their capacity in a cardiovascular manner. So if we're thinking about that overstriding, like landing heavy, spending longer on the ground, you might have a coach saying, okay, you got to run at this pace so that you can keep your heart rate down because we want you working in this heart rate, which makes sense to me. But the athlete runs in a manner that they can't move and feel like they are running at that pace because both feet are going to be on the ground because of their movement pattern. So all of a sudden you've kind of got this disconnect and it's like an athlete saying, oh, well, I don't feel like I'm running now, so I'll start running. Now the heart rate goes up and they're like, oh, shoot, I've gone too fast. So they get caught in between. And then the coach is like, hang on, I'm trying to do the right thing for you and trying to get, you know, you to run in this zone. Mm-hmm. But you keep going out of it and your heart rate's not going to like staying low because the movement doesn't feel like running to that athlete because it's not running. It's just walking fast. And there's the difference between the mechanics. So we're sort of going, okay, well, now we're starting to have a disconnect. So all of this starts to become part of like that coach-athlete relationship, but then we kind of bring it back to what we're talking about now is like the movement pattern itself and technique itself.
Steph, yeah. I'm curious, you coach a lot of people remotely, and I feel like I've run into this recently where people reach out and they're just sort of, you know, life ebbs and flows, life stress can ebb and flow, but certain people have reached out and said like, just everything, it just hurts right now. Mm-hmm. I know, Peter, you're going to tell me run easier, give your body a chance to recover, but like they're just not enjoying the running. And I sometimes develop this like spider sense of like, I think their like hips are off, their movement pattern is off, and I suspect they're hitting the ground in a way that's slightly atypical for them. It's like they're, again, spectrums. They're on their like more out of fluidness movement. You know, usually from afar, I can only solve it with, you know, like, okay, let's take maybe a few days off, and maybe let's move some other, just give your over recovery. But I'm curious how you handle that stuff when you suspect that people are like, maybe we don't know why, but headed towards injury or.
Yeah. And like when they aren't feeling as efficient as they normally are too. Yeah. I know. And that it just starts to pile on that emotional aspect too, in their relationship with the sport. I do tend to err pretty far on the side of caution. Like, and I, of course I like check, go through all the boxes there. I'm like, what does blood work look like? What is your sleep? What does your nutrition look like? What is the totality of personal life stressors been like? And then, I mean, I always feel like it's challenging though, again, like not to bring up the US healthcare system, but it can be so challenging to get the referrals. And then, you know, I feel like I have a strong network like across like the United States, just with colleagues over the years, and like in every major city, I try to at least jot down a handful of physical therapists who are well versed even like gait analysis, form analysis, but it's kind of rare to be able to get in quickly to get assessed for that. So I do feel like there are barriers to sort of like you mentioned, Peter, we have that sort of spidey sense about something brewing, but then it's like, well, who do we reach out to really like pin down what exactly is going on?
I think in a good way, I have found, so I'll just say I've referred multiple people to Paul's online platform to consider the different form cues that Paul, you speak about, and then had a few athletes meet with you in person, because I think in a way, when someone's not proposing an overnight quick fix, you know, like this, do the XYZ method, start running in an XYZ method and you'll be better, then you're not even proposing anything controversial, other than it can be kind of mind bending for people to have someone say to them, can we start to think about how you're moving through space and how you're hitting the ground? I spoke with Ari Hendricks, a woman who I coach, about this, and you know, she's happy for me to share. Like, we were out in January or December on this road, and I filmed her on a bicycle, and then coming out of it, she had had a real struggle of a tempo run, you know, like just not feeling her best. And then, you know, we live in 2024, you want to have that like cool video that you could put up online, and I looked at the video, like, it just, I feel like she's like flinging seconds here and there. It just like felt like her patterns were just, again, not entirely probably different than she's often run, but even a matter of percentage wise, it felt like she just was losing movement. She has a very rotational force. She like, what was it? Kind of leads from her shoulder.
So like we can talk about her, like if you wanted to, about
just as, I think landing it in examples is sort of interesting.
Yeah. Subsequently, we have worked together when I was over in the States last. I think the big thing that you just mentioned there is like, yes, I have like this rotational movement, and we think about like, and I get geeked out by like the physics around that sort of stuff. Like biomechanics is like physics in movement. And so we start to think about summation of movements, which creates summation of forces. And as soon as you create this rotational movement, there's forces going that way. So they're not assisting with or helping with you get off the ground and then maintain that momentum. So if we want to, the analogy I always use is like if you've got a bucket of sand and a bucket of water, they weigh the same. Like once you pick up that bucket of sand and start moving it in the direction, it still costs you to hold it up and keep going. Like, but if the same amount or the same weight in the bucket of water, you're having to get it from A to B, but you're worrying about C, D, E, and F from going around. So you're stabilizing. And that's literally physics. So when you think about running, if you've got these movements going this way, your legs have to work harder to maintain that forward propulsion or that that flight. But it's also going to have to worry about these sideways movements. So then if we start to think about, you know, like trail running, you've got all those movements, and then you've got an uneven surface as well. So there's outside environmental stuff that's going to influence or amplify those movements. So we've got to think about it in a real, coming back to like that basic physics sense. It's just going to leak or cost energy, particularly when we start to think 10K, 42K, 100 mile, you know, like you go, holy shit, like that all costs. So I've got to find it from somewhere to training more, being stronger, you know, loading different areas, or I can go, how can I move better that actually works together and aligns all that stuff? And that then comes back to that. It's not a method. It's kind of, how do I do it so I get the best movement or the best case to get myself from A to B?
I mean, just selfishly here, I'll pop in, just in terms of like trail and ultra athletes. I mean, you're so right. Like I feel like when you extrapolate out over 100 miles and then on, like you mentioned, variable terrain, it's like every little imbalance or inefficiency is just amplified. But in terms of like you're working with trail and ultra runners, I know in our previous conversation before we started recording, you had just mentioned working with some very, very high level trail and ultra athletes. Do you have them focus on like their flat, like sort of road running form first, and then sort of translate over to like say, you know, like how to more efficiently transition like on really steep climbs, right? Like how to make that transition into power hiking and then transitioning out of power hiking into like a fast, like descending. I'm always curious about someone like yourself, that approach there.
Yeah. So the session itself normally is like, we take away as much of the environmental, you know, the outside environmental impact as possible. So to give them the best case, just to kind of get an understanding without having to worry about that. And then we'd like, you know, similar to like on the track, it's like now add speed, fatigue and speed, you know, so, but that becomes part of the training. And particularly with a couple of the athletes, there's one here, Kate Avery. She's actually a GB athlete who started to do a lot more of the kind of the 50K stuff. She was a track athlete. We have, like, fortunately, like I live, you know, 800 meters away from the Yarra, which is the Yarra River, and there's a single trail that runs probably like 12K. So there's ups and downs. So actually on one of the sessions, we've sort of gone out and just gone, okay, so how do you ascend? How do you descend? Like, let's start to implement this cue in this area to give them the best case to be able to actually think about it in that manner. Now, the only change is the environment. The movement shouldn't change. So think about, like, in a trail sense, like, this thought process of, you know, get wide, arms out, so you've got this balance. Yeah. But now we're moving at high paces and we're moving over these surfaces. You want to use that as a safety measure, but then come back in to center of mass so you can actually kind of work through it. So we're not trying to walk on a trapeze. That's where that long length width is actually going to help, because it's going to take away any of those minute movements. Whereas in trail running, it's all about, like, how do we actually move through it smoothly? Mm-hmm. So then you sort of go, okay, how can we bring it back? Or what kind of takes you out? Where do you feel like they kind of come back? You know, you're kind of coming back to center at high paces.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it becomes being able to utilize that then under the stress of different environmental changes.
Yeah. You know what? When you were describing that, I don't know why this phrase popped into my mind over the years, but just as I've become more efficient at, like, technical descending, this is something purely that, like, my brain just made up, like, over the years, but I tell myself to hunker down. Like, that's the phrase. Huh. Like, I don't know why, but, like, when I tell myself that on very technical descending, it, like you just mentioned, it kind of caught, like, forces me to, like, just center myself. And then I feel like I'm able to go faster and increase my speed. And it, I don't know why my brain went to hunker down, but that is a phrase that's been helpful for me over the years with, like I mentioned.
It sounds like you've used it to, like, you know, bring back to center. Like, again, we've got to work close to center of mass so that we can actually maneuver easier. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we want to be able to actually kind of, you know, lean in, and we're going to utilize that center of mass. We've got to have to work close to be able to do that. But even on, like, real steep descents and when they become really technical, a lot of athletes struggle with being able to go fast at that when they're trying to kind of slow themselves down, but they're kind of using, like, a braking method
back,
to slow themselves down. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like lean back, throw the foot out, brake, rather than, no, I still want to be centered. I want to be over my feet. And, yeah, I'm going to have to chop down, but I'm going to spin. I want to use my muscles to arrest or decelerate through eccentric loading through, you know, typically it's quads, rather than just break down and, like, kind of, you know, throw the foot out and kind of each take this heavy impact. You can't go fast and it's hard. But then once you do that and you spin again, your center of mass is over your feet. So then you can actually kind of move with it so much easier as well. Like, the concepts don't change. What changes is the environment. And then it's like, how do we make it bigger, make it smaller? Like, what do we do within that environment?
Yeah.
No,
go ahead, Peter.
I'll find it fascinating because what we're talking about is doing something. And I think too often in running and run coaching, it falls back to just effort level. You know, Paul came and met with my workshop around Boston, and you have downhill, you have flat, you have uphill, you have downhill, and absent sort of something to actively do, we just focus on, make sure you're running easy downhill. Make sure you're not running too hard uphill. Make sure you're finding your right effort level on the flats, which is all very, very important. But since meeting with Paul, you know, again, like, we've all had some experience with running before even thinking about form, and maybe it's been decades of it. So I think when I met with the workshop, I told them all, like, you know, I had been aware of your work, Paul, and this idea of form cues and arm position informing body position informing landing position. And then a friend videoed on a bike next to me at CIM at mile 21. And, you know, it's a great video. It's a beautiful day. And I'm like, why are my arms like almost on the ground? You know, like I know that's not how I would run, you know, in a 5K on the track. And so, you know, it's kind of an unlock to say, where are you, what are you going to actively focus on and do other than all the things your body, you know, slow down, your body's telling you, slow down, or focus on the pain. The pain, it's pain is so intense, you know, I don't want to focus, don't think about the thing that that's front and center. So the idea of form cues, or what are things you can be like, Steph, for you to say, hunker down. Yeah. It's at least something to do rather than saying like, letting the fear of downhill running, you know, absorb your mind.
So like a lot of the athletes will say that, like, and it's not something we'll say, oh, at least you give you something to think about, but so many of them will go, gave me something to focus on, not only to take my mind away from, you know, what's happening, but also it's like, well, if I'm doing that, I'm actually doing a better job of my movement. So I'm able to, you know, hold the pace that I'm trying to hold, or like keep going to the end of the race or whatever it may be. Because they know, we go back to that process of like, I know that's better than what I was doing. So at least it gives me something to focus on. And the other part for me is that's why I do one thing at a time.
Yeah.
So you can do one thing at a time to create habit. Once that habit, like, and it probably just highlights in what you're talking about, Peter, it's like, okay, well, I'm probably not quite there yet. So we wouldn't move on yet. So it's like, okay, how can I bring it back? What is it? Some of the things that it's quite flexible, because you want to go, I want the athlete to get the best out of it. And I want the athlete to create habits. Mm-hmm. And there's no use in going to the next part if we haven't created a habit on the most important part on that, which is the first part, you know, and then whatever's the next is the most important part. So we're kind of like, how can we allow, and how much space do we need to provide that athlete to actually create that habit so that we can continue to progress?
I'm sure it's variable. Like all of this is nuanced athlete to athlete, but in your experience, like how long does it typically take for an athlete? Like sort of like you mentioned, regardless of speed and like talent and ability, but how long do you feel like it takes to implement a habit? And like you said, focusing on one thing at a time.
The thing I love about what I do is that everyone that I see, irrespective of the level of runner that they are wanting to improve at what they're doing. Yeah. So there's this commonality, and it's like, I want to get better at this. Mm-hmm. And like, if you play golf or you swim or something, so like, I want to get better at this. So I'll try and get a better movement, or how can I do this better to get a better outcome? So the beauty about what I do is like everyone I work with is in that. The things that are most impressive to me, and the two examples are like, one's a beginner runner and one's ultra elite. Like a beginner runner sent me a video of their long run. It was like, it would have been 20, 25 Ks into a long run. It was only like 6 days later. And this cue that she was working on just looked awesome. And she said after, I was like, look, I had to concentrate on it a lot, but like it just felt good to be able to hold it for such a long period of time. Mm. So the capacity for her to be able to maintain it for that extended period of time was like, for me, it was awesome. It's such an early stage in it. And the other one was like at Nike HQ with Galen. Like I worked with him on a Thursday, and we did like a thoracic position, like a torso position cue. And he had a 34K workout the next day. And it was by himself, like around the track and around Hollister. And he held it from start to finish at pace. Mm. And I was there just kind of watching it, and he didn't deviate from it. At the end, he's like, oh, I'm cooked. I was like, yeah, man. I was like, that was a hard session. He goes, no, like I'm mentally fried, because I just like, wanted to hold it. So beginner, elite, that impressed me, just to be able to actually maintain that focus, to maintain it the whole time. And that's going to give you best case or a better chance for that cue to be embedded and become habit. But some people, you know, lose concentration, and that's fine. So that's kind of giving them that space to be able to build that habit on their own time.
I love that. I feel like so many things in running, I feel like beginner athletes are so, even just hiring a running coach in general, like let alone hiring someone like yourself, Paul, or even seeking out the assistance of like a sports psychologist, right? I feel like a lot of beginner or like amateur athletes just feel like those types of resources, like not counting like financial barriers and things like that, but they just sort of feel like these are reserved for elite and professional athletes. Mm-hmm. And I just love that example you just used, because gosh, there are so many different reasons, right? Like you mentioned, it being a distraction from like the physical discomfort for a beginner. That's like, you know, it's like, we're trying to build up their aerobic endurance, but it's hard because we want to also be sure that they're running efficiently too. And, you know, correcting any types of really form issues that it's like, we need to address this now early on before it just builds upon itself. But yeah, I love that example you just used because it just underscores the importance of something like this for every ability of athlete.
We're starting to understand how important, you know, process-driven, culture-driven organizations, individuals are. And this process-driven, the whole idea is the cue, is like giving them something to concentrate on to maintain a better version of, if it's, you know, a better version of a runner themselves, an organization. Like that's kind of like, you know, values-based. It's similarly, like, so it's giving them that real purpose. And the comment you made about like the limiting nature to some of this, like professionals, and I don't know if Pete and I, we spoke about it. Like one of the things I was not reluctant to do, but I was reluctant to do like the online sort of outline the whole process of it, because initially you're like, oh, how do you scale it? Because it's an individual thing. It's like, well, this isn't about scaling. Like this is about me trying to actually help athletes. But a guy that does a similar thing in swimming here in Melbourne, he goes, look, I hate to say it, but there's some people that don't want to do one-on-one sessions, you know, like whether it be an intimidation factor or a financial factor, or just like they just don't think that that's what they want to do, or that they just don't think they're ready. You're not providing them with an opportunity to actually improve. And so that was the whole then next phase of, okay, it was like, okay, it's not about scaling, and because it's just not something that sits well with me. It's more about how can I provide what I do and set it out in a manner that they can, like, an easily followable process, so that it is that real kind of, okay, cool, I can kind of just do bit by bit. And yeah, it's not going to be the same as me sitting next to them and going, okay, what does this feel like? But it's at least giving them that capacity to kind of do it themselves at a far, far easier or manageable rate, and that access is pretty easy. So I just kind of like, it's a really good point that you made.
I find it to be, when I try to talk to people about the work you do, I find it frustrating because it would be easier to sell like a system that has three steps and you know, everyone does the 3 to 5 steps and man, it just helps everyone. And yet all the alarm bells would be going off. And yeah, exactly. You'd be like, that's horrible. For anyone who, I worry we haven't hit it on the head, and we'll put it in the show notes, you know, Paul has videos on YouTube that are like helpful illustrative examples of different beginner runners and professional runners, kind of like thinking through their form. Then the platform you can poke around on is very affordable and like really helps you step into it at the level that you're excited to. I mean, I imagine some people blow through it all, Paul, and some people are like, okay, I'm going to internalize a few of these piecemeal. Curious, if someone's listening this deep in and they're geeked out this much, like how would you encourage them to engage, or like what questions should they be asking?
I mean, it just depends on how much they want to get out of it immediately. Like I think similar to Stephanie's, you know, we had looking at the Instagram, you're saying, oh, there's bits and pieces here that you can kind of relate to and you can understand. So you can kind of like have a look there or start to get engaged through it. But the reality is, if there's a real interest in trying to make some change, just like her website has it all set out there. Like that membership based stuff is literally, it's paint by numbers. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't, even as you go through it, it's like, oh no, I don't do that. Or that can relate to me. It's like, cool, I can skip that. I can go to the next bit. There's no, you know, like, you got to go through it all. And it's just to have a look at it and then off you go. It's no problem for me. And it's not even like a leakage of information. It's all there. Because we want to get the athlete to get the best case for them and make the most out of it for them. That's probably the more immediately engagement bit. Otherwise, it's to like have a look at all the other stuff. So you can go, like, oh, okay, well, we've spoken about it, kind of heard about it, but now I can kind of see it in action seeing some of the examples that, like you said, Stephanie. So that's probably the best way. But
I think the questions, maybe it's a trick question for you, because the question should come from the athlete about, I wrote a piece a couple of years ago called like, how do you get hurt? Which is just this idea of self-awareness. And I've never had a bone stress injury, but some people, that's really how they go off the rails. I know that I just like tear up my lower limbs, and with hips getting out of line, you know, the moment my hips are out of line, then all these secondary effects show up. And so you could never tell me like, that's not a thing, Peter, because it's how I go off the rails, you know, and maybe other people never feel that. So I think it's maybe for each athlete to examine, like, what are the roadblocks I run into? And I think at Relay, we're just like a diverse set of runners who all run differently and are like, what are the commonalities? Mm-hmm. Like, we would never say that we all hit the ground in the same way or that we all eat the same way or run the same speed. So we're like, huh, there are some similarities even when we're doing this thing very differently.
I guess it's really important to understand that it's a piece to the puzzle. Mm. So it's not like the panacea change of everything. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to, like, if you've got a coach or if you've got someone giving you bad training advice, it doesn't matter how well you move. Like, you can still get injured. You know, like, I always think about it, it's a pillar of loading. So we're kind of adding another loading pillar. So you've got the loading a pillar that we normally kind of manage, which is, you know, frequency, intensity, you know, distance, all that sort of stuff. We go, oh, how can we manage that? Like, that's been our only manageable load pillar. Mm-hmm. But what this is like, this is a different pillar. So it's a really, I think it's a bigger, important, more important piece to the puzzle than what has been given credit, but it's still just a piece to the puzzle. You know, if you don't recover, if you don't eat well, if you don't train, or if you don't do all the other things, or if you're getting pulled in all these different directions stress-wise, it doesn't matter how well you move, you can still get injured. So I think even that part, it's like, okay, how can I add this string to my bow? How can I add this piece to my puzzle in a manner that's going to add or create other levels of load difference? So it's probably about that too as well. It's not just saying that this is the be all and end all. It's another avenue for improvement, both in performance or getting away from the injury side of things as well.
That's like,
Paul's that type of salesman who won't sell you when you're just Paul,
I hate sales. I cringe at the thought of sales, and like, it's even like, I won't even push push the stuff, because it's like, well, if it works, it works, and it'll go. If it doesn't work, then fucking change it and make it work. So it shouldn't need sales. I think if it's the, you know, product, it shouldn't need sales. It just works or it doesn't.
I do just feel like this is such an important conversation though, because, you know, Peter mentioned writing a piece on how you get injured, I think. And then maybe a couple years later, I wrote a piece that I had Peter then edit and read for me that was like how I found gratitude through injury. And like we've said, like, Paul, like, I used to like wear this, like, I'm so resilient, I never get injured, as this badge of honor. But the reality is, in order to reach the highest level in sport, and that's right, we said that's relative to everyone. I don't just mean podiums, national teams, it can be your personal goals, but it requires taking risks. And taking risks, you know, sometimes comes with injury, you know, unfortunately. Yeah. But I agree with you in that, like you mentioned, it doesn't have to be accepted so much in that way. And I learned that so vividly over the past couple of years that I was like, well, gosh, what the heck? I'm doing all this strength work. I'm like, my bone density is great. My nutrition is wonderful. I'm, you know, trying to emphasize sleep and recovery, and I still got injured, you know? But I think what you just mentioned about like what you do and addressing form as being a piece to the puzzle, a pillar, like, I'm excited to reach out to you like one-on-one after this call, just because I'm like now just nerding out over everything that we've chatted about. And I'm like, huh, maybe that's another piece.
And I think maximize all the other stuff.
I'm excited to chat with you about that, because like I said, I personally have just struggled with like, I understand what my body needs to do, but it's just so different implementing it, like, and putting it into practice. And I hear that a lot from athletes too. So
I think that's a big thing about the form analysis as opposed to gait retraining.
Yeah. Right.
Like, that's been a huge gap, because I think there's a heap of people that do analysis really, really well. And there's like this, you know, this system of being able to break it all down and like highlight everything that's actually happening. And like, that's real, but it's that the gap is the retraining or getting away from or improving the bits that there's the, and it seems small, but it's such a huge gap between the two. Cause you get sent home with, are you doing this, this, and this? And normally it is that, you know, you strengthen this and this, and that'll be better. It's like, well, no, that doesn't change a movement pattern. Like, it's important to safeguard or to make that area more resilient, for sure. So it's not even that's not worth doing, but it's the gap is the retraining.
Yeah, I agree.
And the odd thing to me is like, I mean, Joshua Cheptegei, you know, photos of his feet hitting the ground when he's setting the world record, you think like, that's a crazy footfall. Like he's falling off his spike and it's loading, like almost weird. But, you know, the proof is in the pudding for him. He has the world record that day. It's just to say, even when it's even good, even the best ever can kind of look a certain way that someone could be like, well, that's wrong. You know, that's not working for you. And it, so
and that comes back to like that initial thing that we talked about is like, then it's like the individual's musculoskeletal. So if we use Galen example as well, like he's got a bit of bowed leg and he lands quite laterally on his foot. If his body cannot get into that position, like there's no change you can make to actually put you in that position. Like there's going to be limiting factors. Or if there's like, I work with a heap of triathletes and if they've, you know, they swim a lot and they got some bulk, or if they, because they've cycled, they've had an injury. If they've got a limited range of motion or even like a slightly different angle of, you know, glenoid fossa than one side than the other, it's not like, no, we're going to fit it in to make sure it's symmetrical. We're going to do our best case given the framework that like you presented, which is that athlete.
Mm-hmm. I think the idea that those moments, those days where you're feeling good and you're moving down the road and you have fluid movement, that doesn't have to be random. It's not just like, it didn't. I think at times in my career, I've thought like, shoot, it's on right now. I hope it's on next month when I have my big race because, and so this is, again, there's a lot of inputs, but it's like things to consider in the same way that if your energy stores were, if you just couldn't get out of bed in the morning, you wouldn't just think, I guess it's random whether I can, you know, have that good feeling of fired up for the day.
Thank you so much for trying to make that sweet spot bigger.
Yeah.
Mm. So that sweet spot that you're talking about, that movement is like, that's probably more, muscles and feeling good and like, you know, might be a new pair of shoes or whatever it is. It's like I kind of hit that sweet spot because I'm just feeling great. We want to make that sweet spot so big that it's almost harder to miss because of the movement. You're still going to have that fatigue level through and you're going to feel junky sometimes even if you move really well, but that's going to be because of fatigue, not because of movement.
I feel like that should be the title of this podcast, of this
episode.
We get Paul talking and he gets poetic at times. I love it. One thing I would say to anyone listening is please hit up any of us with, you know, questions. As Relay, Stephanie and I are trying to like take in questions and tackle them on here, bring people on. Yeah. I'm sure that people will have questions from this conversation and, you know, feel free to reach out to any of us, Paul directly around some of his services, or to me and Stephanie around like, you know, what's an additional conversation we could host, or trying to feel like this is the beginning of a conversation. And the scariest part is it is trying to use words to describe movement and flight. And, you know, we didn't even get into this idea of like, if you just Google form cues, people say like, head tall, arms back, 90 degree arms, like all these things. It's like a million things where,
because you could have seen, you would have seen your,
steam coming out of your head.
But it is also something like it can pull apart something. Like, and if we want to use that one quick example before we go, like that whole, you know, run tall but lean forward. Yeah, which one is it? So you're using this, you know, So they're so contradictory, like, and things like that. It is so contradictory, and or lean from the ankles. So you're using your reference point that moves the most when you run as your reference point to lean forward. So all this sort of stuff, you know, that doesn't make sense. And this is exactly why I started. Like, none of this stuff makes sense. Why isn't this? Yeah. And we had to, that's why I kind of started to think about it completely differently. But yeah, that we could go on forever for that stuff.
It'd be interesting. Please reach out to us as this, curious how this sits with people. I'm mindful that, I have found your YouTube videos and some of the Instagram stuff informative, because sometimes for me, being a visual learner, seeing it. So for sure. I know this will go out as a podcast, but you know, checking this stuff out online. Thanks, Paul. I'm sure we'll have cause to speak again, because like this is an endlessly fascinating element of the sport that for years just didn't get talked about.
Yeah. Thank you, Paul. Really appreciate your time. I personally really enjoyed this conversation. And I feel like Peter always laughs at me on the other end because he knows when I'm going to ask guest questions that I'm just like personally invested in.
I can see your wheels turning.
That's great. Way to do it. Because you wouldn't be alone in it. Like you'd be asking questions that other people are personally invested in as well. Right? Yeah.
Absolutely. No, it's exciting stuff. I like that. We're here to geek out. So it's fun. Thanks for coming on, Paul.
That's right.